privilege to start by introducing Professor, well, the Reverend Dr. John Polkinghorne. I suppose I should say Professor Emeritus of Mathematical Physics at Cambridge.
Not strictly, but that doesn't matter.
Quite. Who actually gave up his chair to train for ordination in the Church of England. He's held a number of appointments in the Church, finally becoming President of Queen's College, Cambridge. He's a Templeton Prize winner, a very distinguished writer in the area of science and religion over many, many years now. And I don't think we could have anyone better to introduce this topic, John. Thank you. Space, time, and eternity.
Right, am I, yes, am I audible? Wave at the back if I am. Thank you. Okay, great. Well, it's a privilege to have the opportunity of speaking about this. And I have a title with three big words in it. And perhaps the least difficulty we have with those words is with the first word, space. It doesn't seem too perplexing a subject. You don't find too many books written about the philosophy of space or the theology of space. And I suppose the reason for that is that we can move around in space. We can explore it in that sort of way. And equally significantly, we can stand still in space. If we want to stay somewhere, we can stay there. And that means that we feel there is a certain easy accessibility and a flexibility of our experience by our encounter with space. And therefore, we don't feel very puzzled by it most of the time. But there is one question, I suppose, we need to discuss about space a bit, and that is how much of it is there? If we think about our universe, that, of course, depends upon the space-time structure of the universe. If the universe has an elliptical space-time structure, then space is finite but unbounded in a way that we all understand, like the surface of a sphere, but one dimension up. On the other hand, if space is asymptotically flat, or if it's hyperbolic, then space will be unlimited. Observationally, we're very close to the asymptotically flat position. So it's hard to be sure exactly whether space is in our universe is finite or infinite. But a more interesting question is, that's our universe, but how many universes are there? And you all know that there is a lot of speculation and a lot of popularity of thinking about our universe as just being one particular specimen of an immense portfolio of different universes, a vast multiverse, in which there are all sorts of different universes, different sizes, different laws of nature, different strengths of forces, and so on and so on. An idea of quite incredible ontological prodigality. Poor old William of Ockham, I think, must be turning in his grave at the thought of the multiplication of these entities, because all these other universes are inaccessible to us. They are not directly observable to us. So why should we believe that they might exist? Well, there's a sort of chain of motivation. I suppose it started, really, with the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, which actually is exactly 50 years old this year. 50 years ago, a young man, Hugh Everett III, was thinking about the interpretation of quantum theory, and you know, one of the great problems in the interpretation of quantum theory is the measurement problem. Quantum theory predicts probabilities. Maybe the electron will be here, maybe the electron will be there. And the theory enables us to calculate with very, very great exactitude those relative probabilities. But on any particular occasion, when we look and see where the electron is, we find it here or there. One of these possibilities is realized. And the big question is, still an unresolved question, 80 years after the development, more than 80 years after the development of modern quantum theory, is what brings it about that we get a particular result on a particular occasion? Well, conventional quantum theorists in the tradition of Niels Bohr, and I'm a conventional quantum theorist, I have to admit that, we believe that that's brought about by a rather mysterious process called the collapse of the wave function. All the probability somehow gets concentrated on here, if that's where we find the electron. That's an imposition on the theory. It doesn't come out of the theory, it's just an extra thing that we bolt on. And its consistency is obviously open to question. And young Hugh Everett thought it should be questioned, that we should take basic quantum theory absolutely seriously, and that means that everything that could happen must therefore happen. The electron is here, the electron is there, even after measurement. Schrodinger's cat, that unfortunate animal whose history I'm sure is known to all of you, incarcerated in that box with a radioactive source that will trigger the release of a poison gas to kill the cat, maybe. is both alive and dead. Well, obviously, Schrödinger's cat can't be alive in just one universe, so there must be a whole series of parallel worlds. One in which Schrödinger's cat lives, one in which Schrödinger's cat dies. One in which the electron is here, one in which it's there, one in which it's somewhere else. So according to Everett, the whole universe continually keeps on splitting up into a whole series of parallel worlds in which all the different possibilities, the result of measurement, are realized. And of course, since you and I might be conscious of those results, we in some sense are getting split up all the time between those worlds as well. It's a pretty prodigal assumption, but at least it isn't really quite a multiverse in the popular contemporary sense. Because all those parallel universes, they have different realized histories. The history in which the cat lives, the history in which the cat dies, but they all have the same physical structure. They all have the same laws of nature, the same constants specifying the strength of the forces of nature. So it's a big, big, big portfolio of worlds, but it's not big enough for some people. But some people want a truly multiverse in which the universes have lots of different characteristics. And they feel, many people feel, they're motivated in that belief by string theory. So let me just say one or two words about string theory. String theory is a very interesting enterprise. It is to ask the question, what would relativistic quantum theory look like if we formulated, not in terms of point-like entities, which is our conventional way of thinking about it, but in terms of little, initially, one-dimensional strings, little tiny vibrating strings. They are tiny. They will have the dimensions of about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters across. But people found that if you suppose that was the case, that these strings would have various modes of vibration, and these modes of vibration could be associated with the different point-like particles that we feel we observe in the world. And in particular, they found it was initially a problem, and then vice became a virtue. They found that these theories always had in them zero-mass spin-through particles. And that was perfect if you wanted to have gravity, because that's exactly what gravitons, the hypothesized, and we all believe in gravitons, though nobody's ever seen one, that's exactly the properties that gravitons would have. They would have zero mass, because gravity has an infinite range, and they would be spin-true, because that's the character of gravitational forces. So here was, for the first time, the promise of a way of putting together relativity theory, general relativity theory, the theory of gravity, and quantum mechanics in a way that looked as though it should be consistent. That's, again, a task that people have been struggling with for more than 80 years. It's a remarkable fact about 20th century modern physics. The two greatest discoveries of 20th century modern physics were quantum theory on the one hand, general relativity, the theory of gravity on the other. They are, unless string theory is right, they are imperfectly reconciled with themselves. We cannot put the two together without having all sorts of inconsistencies and infinities appearing. But string theory seems to offer the opportunity of doing that. So people got very enthusiastic about it. And the original hope was that there would be only one string theory, a unique theory, or possibly just a very small number of theories. However, it didn't turn out to work out that way. And the reason for it was this. String theories cannot consistently be formulated in three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. They have to be formulated in either 10 or 11 dimensions of space-time. So you need 6 or 7 extra dimensions of space if you're going to make a string theory work. But our friends, our bold people, they say, that's okay. Those dimensions will get folded up. They'll get compactified. And again, it'll be on a scale of about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So they really will be very tiny. And we'll be unaware of them. So they can be compactified, and then we can get a resulting four-dimensional theory that we can compare with experiment. But the trouble is, the number of ways in which you can compactify the theory is very, very extensive indeed. And in fact, current estimates suggest that there are 10 to the 500 different ways of getting sensible four-dimensional space-time physics out of string theory. Well, you might be a little bit upset by that if you've been looking for a unique theory, but our friends say, no, that means there must be at least 10 to the 500 different universes in this vast multiverse, each realizing one of these different ways of doing it. Fundamental physics has become extraordinarily speculative in the last 30 years. I worked in fundamental physics, in particle physics, for about 25 years. During the whole of that time, it was experimentally driven. Our experimental friends were continually putting tests to the theories, saying, we found this, make sense of that. There were some very clever theorists around, and they did make sense of that. And the standard model, the so-called standard quark model of matter, emerged out of all that. Since that time, the experimental input has reduced very much, and the theoretical confidence has risen very extensively. So that the string theorists claim to be able to tell you what nature is like 16 orders of magnitude beyond anything of which we have direct experience. Well, they're very clever people, and they make very interesting suggestions, but the lessons of history are against our ability to second-guess nature over such a vast distance range, or equivalently, energy range. But that's what people are doing. And it is the 10 to the 500 that provides the current motivation for the multiverse. And the attraction of that is that it helps people perhaps to deal with the remarkable anthropic fine-tuning of our universe without importing the threat of theism, which is something that people, many people in the game don't want to countenance. I won't go into the fine-tuning business, but the most striking fine-tuning of all is the fine-tuning of the cosmological constant, or of the thing that gives the magnitude of dark energy. That's an energy which is associated with space itself. That there is such an energy is not altogether surprising, because in the quantum world, empty space is not inactive space. There are always quantum fluctuations, very severe quantum fluctuations. These fluctuations generate energy. And on the basis of thinking about them, you can figure out how much energy there ought to be in a particular slab of space. And it turns out to be a very large number. Now, cosmologists and astronomers feel that they have probably observed the presence of dark energy in our universe, which will be then a force that is driving the expansion, partly driving the expansion of the universe, but it's a very, very small number compared with what you might regard as being the reasonable expectation. In fact, the observed value is 10 to the minus 120 times the natural expected value. And that's an anthropically necessary thing, because if it was to any appreciable degree bigger than that, the universe would be just blown apart too fast for any complex structure to evolve within it. And the claim is, okay, if you've got 10 to 500 universes to choose from, with a bit of luck, one of them surely is pretty unlikely to be 10 to the 120 smaller, but with a bit of luck, with 10 to 500 to play with, you might find at least a few with that feature. And so you try and explain away fine-tuning in that sort of way. Our universe is anthropically fruitful simply because it, by chance, is the winning ticket in a multiversal lottery for the existence of carbon-based life. Well, maybe. Of course, a theory that has 10 to the 500 different possibilities can explain pretty well anything. There's a very real sense in which a theory that explains anything, it doesn't explain anything at all. So I think we should be careful about it. And moreover, it's by no means clear, actually, even with 10 to 500, that you could actually do it. There's lots of difficulties in applying the notion of probability to the immense ensemble of different universes. You have to have some sort of measure on that ensemble, and how you should define that is a very tricky business. If you want to pursue that, it's a very good book written by our chairman here, with a rather catch-all title, I have to say. It's called God, the Multiverse and Everything, which discusses in a careful way some of the difficulties associated with that. But there's no doubt, one of the reasons that has given the multiverse such popularity is precisely because it seems to diffuse the threat of theism that might otherwise be lurking around in relation to our particular universe. So that's all I want to say about space, really. There's certainly a lot of it, even in our universe. Maybe there's a lot more, maybe there isn't. But what about time? Well, time is, of course, quite different. In fact, completely different. We can't move around in time of our own volition. Time travel is not available to us. Moreover, we can't stand still in time. We are continually being swept through time through a succession of fleeting present moments. And that's what produces, that experience is what produces our perplexity about the nature of time. It's almost a convention in giving a theological talk about time to start with quoting that famous passage from Augustine's Confessions, in which Augustine says that he knows what time is, but he doesn't think about it. But as soon as he starts to think about it, he's puzzled and perplexed. Precisely because he never seems to be able to get a grip on the present moment. As soon as he tries to do so, it's gone. And that's the perplexity of time. And the big, of course, general relativity ties together space and time and matter in a sort of big package deal. It's a very beautiful theory that does that. But of course, that doesn't mean that space and time are just the same sort of thing. History is different from geography for precisely the reasons I've been talking about, our access to it, our ability to move around in it. So time is, I think, uniquely perplexing. And the big question about time relates to the flow of time. And the big question is, does time really flow? You and I think it does, but are we is that just a trick of our human psychological perspective? Is it just the way we track down our world lines, our paths through the space-time continuum, just the way we experience it, but is the true reality, in fact, the total space-time continuum, something that people call the block universe? In other words, the true notion of time is that it is not flow, it is just there, the whole of history, so to speak, in that sort of way. That's a view that Einstein very much embraced. In fact, when his great friend Michele Besso died, Einstein wrote a letter to Michele's widow, comforting her by saying that Michele is not lost, he's back there in the space-time continuum, we can't access him any longer, but he's not lost, he's still stuck there in the amber of space-time. Whether she found that a consoling thought or not, I don't know. That's what Einstein thought, but was Einstein right about it? Well, people who want to support the block universe usually make two kinds of arguments in its favor. And the first argument they make is to think about special relativity, actually, and to think about the fact that, the true fact, that in special relativity, different observers make different judgments about the simultaneity of distant events. If I'm standing here and I judge two distant events to be simultaneous, if you're moving with respect to me, you have to be moving with a fair fraction of the velocity of light to make this perceptible, but if you are doing that, then you will make a different judgment about those two events, A and B. If you're moving in one way, you'll think that A comes before B. If you're moving another way, you think B comes before A. There is absolutely no doubt that in special relativity, and therefore extended into general relativity, different observers make different judgments of the simultaneity or otherwise of distant events. And if that's the case, if one observer thinks A and B are simultaneous, another one thinks that A is before B, third one thinks that B is before A, doesn't that mean that all these time differences are in fact illusory, and therefore we are back with the block universe? That's the argument. And at first sight, it has a sort of specious plausibility about it, but I think it's wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that no observer has knowledge of a distant event until that event is unambiguously past, is unambiguously in its past light cone. And the different ways in which observers assign simultaneity or non-simultaneity to distant events relates to the way in which they organize the description of their unambiguously past experience. They do organize that description in different ways. But that of itself cannot prove the already existing reality of the future. So I think that argument is a bogus argument. Not all physicists are going to agree with me, but that's what I think. So that's one argument, which I think is not a valid argument. A second argument is sometimes not stated quite so bluntly as I'm going to put it now, but is that relativistic physics contains in itself no representation of the present moment. T equals zero, so to speak, has no particular status. And if the physics doesn't recognize a status of the present moment, then maybe the argument is our experience of apparent experience of the present moment is illusory. Well, it's correct that physics doesn't include a representation of the present moment, but I would say so much the worse for physics. I mean, you have to be a crass physicalist reductionist, believing that physics is everything, to believe that that sort of argument, a deficiency in physics' description of the world, is a reason for supposing that our very direct, I think irreducible experience of the moving of the present moment is an illusion. So I don't sign up to that argument either. And in fact, while it's true that physics on a local scale doesn't contain a representation of the present moment, if you look at physics on a cosmic scale, there is a sort of natural representation of the present moment for the universe itself. We've learnt, of course, that cosmology is getting very accurate. We've learnt the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Now, that's a statement which must have a reference to a particular frame of reference, a cosmic now, if you like. Cosmic now is 13.7 billion years after the now of the Big Bang. And that frame of reference is defined in our universe because our universe, on the largest scale, is almost homogeneous. There is the cosmic background radiation that you all know about, and there is a natural frame of reference to describe the age of the universe. And so, if you like, to define a cosmic now, which corresponds to a frame at rest with the overall structure of the background radiation of the universe. And that's what cosmologists mean when they talk about the age of the universe. Well, you might say it's pretty odd, really, isn't it, to think that such a great cosmic thing like that somehow has the effect of producing our local experience of a moving present moment. Well, it is a bit odd, but it's not unprecedented. Some of you will know about Mach's principle. Ernst Mach, the positivist physicist philosopher of the early 19th century, pointed out that there is a connection between local physics here, and global physics, the physics of the universe around us, in that inertial frames of reference here on Earth, the frames of reference in which dynamics takes its most transparent and simple form, are at rest or in uniform motion with respect to the fixed stars. In other words, local inertial properties are somehow related to the overall distribution of matter in the universe. That's called Mach's principle. One of these things have been endless arguments to and fro in the sort of physics philosophy borderline about what to make of that. But if you take that seriously, and I think you should take it seriously, then that is another example of a cosmic local connection. So it's not totally out of court that there might be some connection between our current experience of now and the frame of reference that defines the age of the universe. So that's the block universe view. But of course, I myself don't subscribe to it. I believe in a universe of unfolding becoming. I believe that our experience of the flow of time is a true experience, and our description of the universe should be a description of a universe of a moving present moment, dividing the known and fixed past from the unknown and open future. Which shall we choose? Shall we choose the block universe, or shall we choose the universe of becoming? Well, I don't think physics tells us which to choose. I think it's either of those choices is consistent with what physics can say. I don't think either is demanded by what physics can say, but I think both of them are consistent with what physics can say, and therefore it is a metaphysical choice rather than a physical choice about whether we believe in the block universe or a universe of unfolding becoming. Everybody, metaphysics is a word that scientists on the whole don't like, but everybody has a metaphysics, whether you like it or not, just as everybody speaks prose, whether you know it or not. Everybody has a worldview, and our worldview is constrained by our scientific understanding of the world, but it is not determined by our scientific understanding of the world. Physics constrains metaphysics, but doesn't determine metaphysics. And we have a choice. We can either put our money on the block universe, or we can put it on the universe of becoming. And if we make that choice, we will make it for various meta-scientific, metaphysical reasons, rather than believing, wrongly in my view, that we can read it out of science itself. And I might just mention at the same time that there is another very important aspect of the world that is also metaphysical, also constrained by physics, in the way that it's a bit like the way the foundations of a house construct the building that you can erect upon it. They don't determine the building, but obviously, of course, they constrain it. And so our physics constrains, but doesn't determine metaphysics. That's true, I think, of temporality, the nature of time. I think it's also true of causality. We had a little bit of discussion yesterday, really in passing, about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Somebody from the floor said that was an epistemic principle. He didn't quite use those words. It's a principle of measurement, what you can know. And that's absolutely right. Heisenberg got into it by figuring out you couldn't measure exactly where an electron was and what its momentum was. How you interpret that, how you go from epistemology, what you know, To ontology, what is the case, is a fundamental philosophical problem, and perhaps the philosophical problem in the philosophy of science, and there is no entailment between the two. You have to, again, make a matter of metaphysical decision about what connection you will make. If you are Immanuel Kant, perhaps the most influential philosopher of the modern period, you think there's virtually no connection. The appearances of things, phenomena, loom out of a sort of fog, but the nature of things in themselves, noumena, are unknown to us. I think that's an unduly pessimistic view about our... Most scientists, almost all scientists, I venture to say, are realists. If you're a realist, you believe that what we know is a reliable guide to what is the case. My wife once gave me a sweatshirt with the beautiful words she'd often heard me speak, inscribed upon it, "Epistemology models ontology." You get a pretty funny look if you walk down the street wearing that. But what it means is, what we know is a reliable guide to what is the case, and I, therefore, again with most physicists, interpret Heisenberg's uncertainty principle not simply as an epistemic principle of ignorance, but as an ontological principle of true indeterminacy. But you don't have to interpret it that way. And I think we were reminded yesterday, David Bohm, very clever man David Bohm, produced a theory in which is totally deterministic in its character. He, of course, has Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, because his theory produces the same experimental consequences as conventional quantum theory. So he has all that sort of stuff. But for him, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle really is just a principle of ignorance. And how do we choose between the two? Not from physics. Empirical evidence is the same for both. Again, it's a matter of metaphysical choice. And the third thing I want to say while I'm in this area is that what we decide about temporality, what we decide about causality, are independent decisions. You can have a block. The block universe or unfolding universe is about the nature of time. Causality is about the nature of the entailment relationships between the events that take place in time. You can have a perfectly block universe view of the world, but have an open causality operating in that block universe. It needs a bit of thinking about, but if you think about it, I think you'll see that's the case. Rather easier is to think about Laplace, think about a Laplacian universe. In Laplace's universe, everything's determined. So if you know the present perfectly, you can predict the future and retrodict the past. You might think that such a view of the universe would be naturally described in terms of the block universe. But Laplace, of course, didn't think of it that way. It wasn't an option on his metaphysical range of possibilities at that time. And though he believed in a universe of strict determinism, it was a universe of unfolding temporal process. So what we choose about temporality, what we choose about causality, are independent of each other. And that's an important thing, I think, to keep in mind. And it's about time I said something about God. And so next thing I want to discuss is, how does God relate to time? Of course, all theists, I think, are going to see clearly that there is an eternal aspect to the divine nature. That God is not enthralled to time. We believe that time came into being with the existence of the universe, with the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. For sure, God didn't come into being at the Big Bang. So there's undoubtedly an eternal, totally atemporal aspect to the divine nature. Which reflects, for example, God's unchanging hesed, God's unchanging faithfulness, which is not qualified by time at all. So all theists, I think, will believe that there is an irreducible eternity present in the divine nature, a total atemporality. But the question is there something in addition to that? How does the atemporal, eternal God relate to a temporal creation? And basically, in the history of theology, there have been two fundamental approaches to that. One is the approach of classical theology in the West, stemming from people like Boethius and Augustine, through Aquinas, and then through Calvin, and so on to the present day. And that picture sees God as wholly, totally, unexceptionally outside of time. And God looks down on the whole of the time of creation laid out before the divine gaze. And Aquinas emphasized that view of God's knowledge of history does not abolish human free will. I think if God had foreknowledge of the acts of a free being, that would be a contradiction. Not all theologians have even agreed that. There was a Jesuit theologian, Luis Molina, who thought that God could have middle knowledge, could have knowledge beforehand of what a free agent would do. But I don't think that's consistent. But God does not, the God of classical theology does not have foreknowledge of any event, because the whole of history is simultaneous to the atemporal divine gaze. God knows the whole of history, totum simul, all at once. God knows what I'm doing now, God knows what I did yesterday, God knows what I will do tomorrow, in exactly the same way. That's the picture of classical theology. And if that's correct, it has a curious implication, or at least it's an implication that's very seldom drawn. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen it drawn in the theological literature. You see, we surely believe also that God knows things as they truly are. Divine knowledge is true knowledge. And if God knows the whole of history all at once, laid out before the atemporal divine gaze, God knows cosmic history as knowledge of the block universe. And therefore, it seems to me that classical theology endorses, or should be seen to endorses metaphysically, the concept of the block universe. Well, is there any other possibility? Well, there is another possibility of rather more recent provenance than classical theology, and it's commonly called open theology, and it's been a very important movement with various kinds of articulations in the course of the 20th century. And open theology says this. It says that, of course, that there is an eternal pole in God. But when God brought into being a temporal universe, God, as an act of gracious condescension, chose to engage with the time of that creation. In other words, open theology believes that there is, of course, an eternal pole in God, an unchanging pole in God, but there is also a temporal pole in God. And that God, if the universe is truly a universe of becoming, you see, equally, since we argue that God knows things truly in accordance with their natures, then it seems to me that follows that God will not simply know that events are successive in our world, but God will know them according to their natures, which means in their succession. And that means that God has a true engagement with time. That's not imposed upon, process theology, which follows the thought of Alfred North Whitehead, believed had a dipolar view of God, that was both time and eternity in the divine nature. But the Whiteheadians believe that's a metaphysical necessity. God didn't have any choice about that. That's the way the world has to be. I don't think that's right. I think that if I'm correct, I'm an open theologian myself, if I'm correct in believing that God engages with time in this sort of way, it is an act of divine decision, not imposed upon the divine nature, but it's a gracious act of God's choosing to relate to a temporal creation in a temporal way. God knows events not simply that they are successive, but God knows them in their succession. Well, if that's right, and I don't suppose everybody's going to shout amen immediately when I've said that, if that's right, then it carries all sorts of theological implications with it. And those theological implications are part of another important development of theology in the 20th century, not unprecedented before it, but particularly clearly articulated in the 20th century, which is a recognition, an acknowledgement, that God's act of creation is a divine act of kenosis, of divine self-limitation. Again, not imposed upon God from outside, to suppose that would be the sinful error of magic, but graciously accepted by God as an act of loving creatively work. First sort of flowerings of kenotic theology were in relation to God's limitation of power. It seems to me that Christian theology has a bit of a dilemma in thinking about how God relates to the processes of creation. Certainly God can't be just an indifferent deistic spectator who set it all spinning and then stands back and says, gee, I wonder what's going to happen. God must have more concern for creation than that. But equally, I think that the God of love cannot be simply the cosmic puppet master, the cosmic tyrant, as Whitehead would have said, who pulls every string and makes everything happen. The gift of love is always the gift of some form of due independence to the object of love. Those of our parents know that. We have to allow our children to be themselves, and to make themselves as they grow up. Little Johnny or little Jean learn how to ride a bicycle. They have to be allowed to go out eventually into the traffic, the dangerous traffic, on their own. God allows creatures to be themselves, and God allows creatures, through the fruitful unfolding process of evolution, even allows creatures to make themselves. That was Charles Kingsley and Frederick Temple's way of describing evolution immediately following Darwin's insight, and I think it's still the best theological way of thinking about an evolving world. So the gift of love is always the gift of some form of due independence. And that involves, of course, a self-limitation of divine power. Not everything that happens in the world is in accordance with God's will. God allows it to happen. But I don't believe that God wills the act of a murderer, though God allows the person to whom free will has been given to commit the act of murder. I also don't believe, actually, that God wills tectonic plates to slip and produce earthquakes. Lots of things happen in the world that are allowed to be because of the divine restriction of power, that God is not the cosmic tyrant. That's a limitation of power. But it's also a self-limitation that the God who possesses eternity has chosen to engage with time. And if that's the case, I think that will involve in God a kenosis not only of power, of omnipotence, if you like, self-limitation of omnipotence, but also, I think, a kenosis of knowledge. This is where we get really controversial. A kenosis of knowledge, an acceptance that God's omniscience is not a total omniscience. Every theist will surely believe that God knows everything that is knowable. But in the world of unfolding becoming, I think the future is not yet there to be known, even by God. So I think God possesses what the philosophers call a current omniscience. God knows all that can be known today, but God does not know yet everything that will be knowable. And that limitation of divine knowledge is not an imperfection. It's not imposed upon God, but it's an accepted self-limitation of divine power. Now, if that's right, does it make sense? Well, I really say it's not an imperfection. I also think that, of course, when I say that, though I believe God accepts truly the experience of created time, God is not enthralled to time in the same way that you and I are. We are just carried along by time. I don't think God sees the future, but God certainly sees with a clarity that no creature could begin to approach the way in which the currents of history are moving. So we are continually caught out by the future, but I don't think God is caught out by the future in that sort of way. Let me give you an example. I mean, the big question here is prophecy, I suppose. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar comes along with the Babylonian armies and he invests Jerusalem. God sees that Pharaoh is not going to come up from Egypt and rescue Judah from the invading Babylonians. And so God sends Jeremiah to warn the king that that's not going to happen and that the king should make peace with Nebuchadnezzar on the best terms he can get. Of course, the king doesn't do that. We all know what happens. That, I think, is what prophecy is concerned with. It's not concerned with God having taken a sneak view of a film of the future, but God seeing how the forces of history are moving, and if necessary, sending messages through God's servants to that effect. So I think God saw that Jerusalem was going to fall. I don't think God saw beforehand exactly which Babylonian soldier would be the first to put the torch to the temple to burn it down. You see the distinction I'm trying to make? And I think that's sufficient to deal with questions of prophecy. And it seems to me that the God who engages truly with history is very much the God who is described in the Bible. The God who engages with the unfolding history of Israel. And of course the God who engages in history in a very unique way in the episode of the Incarnation, a birth under Augustus and a death under Tiberius. But let's think about ancient Israel. The Hebrew scriptures are astonishingly bold in the anthropomorphic way that they talk about God's relationship with Israel. They do not hesitate to speak about God changing God's mind. God sends a message to Hezekiah, you're going to die. Hezekiah says, I don't want to die, Lord. God says, okay, 15 more years of life. Now that's obviously anthropomorphic. I mean, it can't be quite as simple and straightforward as that. But it's a representation, I think, of the way in which the Israelites took absolutely seriously, and rightly took seriously, God's involvement with their unfolding history. And God often sends messages to people saying, unless you repent, this is going to happen, but if you do repent, it's going to be all right. Ezekiel's full of that sort of thing. So I think that this idea of a God who truly engages with time and truly accepts the limitations of history is consistent with taking absolutely seriously the God whose nature is revealed to us through the record of Scripture. So that's the choice. Now these are deep and contentious matters, and I can't believe for a minute that everybody here is going to agree to think about these things in the same sort of way. If I'd had more time, I would talk not only about the past and the present, but also about the future. We know that the universe is going to end in futility, most probably through continuous expansion and increasing cold and dilution. Carbon-based life is certain to prove a transient episode in the history of the universe. We need to take that seriously, if we take time seriously. And of course, the horizontal story that science tells always ends in futility, whether it's our life histories on the time scale of tens of years, or the universe's time life history on the scale of many hundreds of billions of years. In the end, all ends in futility. Disorder always wins over order, as far as science can tell. But we, of course, theology and Christian believers can tell a vertical story of God's faithfulness. And that's the only ground of the hope of a destiny beyond death, either for us or for the whole of creation. And of course, a sufficient ground for the hope of a destiny beyond death for us and creation. And I think that our destiny beyond death, when we try and make some sort of sense about that, I mean, I know wait and see is the best answer, but we ought to try and make some sort of sense about it. And it will involve both continuity and discontinuity. It must be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will live again in the kingdom of God, but they won't live again just in order to die. So there will be a change. Death will be no more. But just as our Christian hope is not just the spiritual survival, but is resurrection, because we believe that we have to be re-embodied to be truly human again. Not, of course, in the flesh and blood of this world, but we have to be re-embodied. That's our hope. So I believe it's intrinsic to human beings not only to be embodied, but also to be temporal. And I think that the life of the world to come is going to be a life that also has time in it, different from the time of this world. Our destiny is not eternity. That's something that only belongs to the divine nature. Our destiny is the endless and inexhaustible exploration of the riches of the divine nature made available to us in the unfolding life of the world to come. There will be time in the world to come, just as there's time in this world. I don't think that our destiny is a sort of timeless moment of illumination, a beatific vision. So I think that their temporality is with us to stay, so to speak, even if it won't be just the time of this world. Every speaker is allowed one short commercial, and if you're interested in what I think about future destiny, you could buy a little book available at Pure Novels charge called The God of Hope and the End of the World. But let's stick with what I've mostly said about the nature of time and the nature of God's involvement with time. Perhaps we can have a conversation about that.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we do have quite a length of time for questions, which is terrific. So who would like to ask a question? Yeah, look at that.
It's rather hard with everything you've said to be limited to just one question, but let me focus on one thing, and particularly in connection with the possible existence of the future and God's knowledge of it. A number of theologians have emphasized the idea, and I think it's been mentioned here a couple of times, the idea that Christ and especially the resurrection of Christ are a a genuine prolepsis of God's ultimate future, that a genuine revelation of what God's ultimate future for creation is to be. And it's a little difficult to see how that could be the case if, in some sense, that ultimate future did not actually exist.
Oh, well, thank you for raising that. Perhaps let me tell you how I react to that. I mean, I think God's creative purposes are intrinsically a two-step purpose. God brings into being, first of all, the old creation, of which we are part, but God's eventual purpose is to turn the whole of the old creation into the new creation, to transform it. The new creation is not a second attempt by God to create out of nothing, to try and do it a bit better than he did the first time. It's the redemption of the old creation. And that process of redemption has already begun. The resurrection of Christ is the seminal event for which the new creation has begun to grow. And incidentally, that's why the empty tomb was empty, because the Lord's body, the matter of this creation, was transformed, transmuted into the glorified matter of the new creation. So in some sense, the old creation and the new creation at the moment are existing side by side with each other in a way that's easier for mathematicians to imagine perhaps than other people. And so God's future, God's ultimate future for creation isn't the end of this process, the end of history of the old creation. It's already coming into being through Christ's resurrection. So I think that's some sort of answer to your point. Obviously, it would need more extensive and careful discussion, but that would be the lines on which I would think about it. And I have to say, I'm very leery about a lot of modern, Lutheran theology, Pannenberg and people who have such an emphasis on the role of the future. I think that is a dangerous way of thinking about things.
Thank you. Yes. James, here.
Yes, John. From yesterday and today, your talk, from Simon Conway Morris, he seems to suggest that it's a micro evolution and macro design. From cosmic point of view, should we say that it's a micro farewell and macro destination?
Well, well, that's an interesting way of putting it. I'm not too keen in dividing up the micro and the macro worlds. I want to try and take as integrated a view of things as possible. I think that God has purposes for the whole of creation. That's a point that's come up several times in our discussion. Colossians very much underlies that, Christ who redeems all things by the blood of his cross. And so there is a macro, cosmic macro purpose for the whole of God's creation. But because God works, I think, through process and not through magic, the coming to be of that, to some extent, is a micro process in our individual hearts and lives and so on and so on. So I think I'd probably want to rephrase that a little bit along those lines, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Any more questions? I think there's one next to Ruth.
Do we really have to choose between the classical theology and this open theology? I mean, there seems to be this emphasis on transcendence and immanence in these respective cases. And if we put the emphasis too much on the immanence, how can we be sure that the outcome is as is described here without having this aspect of total transcendence
theology? Thank you for saying that. Yes, I'm behind all this, there is this question of balancing transcendence and immanence in the divine relationship. Also, of course, grace and free will. I mean, all these dualities come up. I think many of us think that classical theology too greatly emphasized the transcendence of God. It kept God too remote up in this realm of eternity from the unfolding temporality of God's creation. I mean, you know, Aquinas said that God acts on creatures, but creatures don't act on God. And I think that's a very chilling and mistaken thing to say. Now, it is undoubtedly the case that open theology is in danger of placing too great an emphasis on divine immanence. I think that's certainly true of process theology. One of the reasons I don't accept process theology, I have several reasons. One of the reasons is that the process God is just too devoid of power. He is a sort of persuasive pleader on the margins of occurrence. And to put it bluntly, the God of process theology is not the God who raised our Lord Jesus Christ from the dead. So I think we have to try and keep the balance. But I think we do need both. And God, certainly a God who is simply, I said that God engages with time but is not enthralled with time. If God is too imminent, so imminent that God is totally caught up in time, then of course God cannot be the saviour from the intrinsic futility that's built into present temporal process. So I agree, you have to get the balance right. But all of I'm an Anglican, remember, so the whole of theology is sliding down a knife edge with disaster and heresy on both sides.
Yes, well put. More questions. There are several in that block, but perhaps the first one nearest in. Yep.
I'd like to suggest another Alan Guth's take on multi-universes, which, as I understand it, his inflationary model, solves the horizon problem in the present big ball. Yeah. Out of that model also comes that same model, which sort of explains the universe we now see, the cosmic black body radiation. That same model also contains the spawning of many universes. It's just sort of part of that theory.
Yeah, well, there are two points there, really. There is a theory that is speculative, but I think very well motivated, that our universe, at a very, very early epoch, which is about 10 to the minus 35 seconds old after the Big Bang, had a sort of boiling of space. Space expanded exponentially fast for a little while. And that smooths things out. It explains lots of things about the present world, its apparent flatness, its homogeneity, and so on, which would be difficult to understand otherwise. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. People then stir that idea. That's called inflation. It was thought of by a chap called Alan Guth. People stir that idea with highly speculative ideas about quantum cosmology to create processes by which there is a sort of background to everything. You have to be given string theory or relativity and quantum mechanics for free. Once you're given that, you have this sort of background, and things keep on fluctuating and popping up, and sometimes inflation blows them up into universes, and so you generate a multiverse that sort of way. Well, it's an interesting theory. We really do not understand quantum cosmology yet. And we do not, I think, truly understand how to combine quantum theory with relativity. For example, string theory is formulated in a 10 or 11 dimensional space-time background. But a true theory, and loop quantum gravity is trying to do this, would generate the background and not have to assume it. So I think we have to be very, very wary about placing too much money on any of the highly ingenious, very interesting, but not to me fully persuasive half ideas, I think, that come out of quantum cosmology. I think we really need to be careful.
Thank you.
But remember, I'm elderly. My generation are very suspicious of all these things.
Oh, rightly so, I think. Perhaps this one at this end? Yeah.
Hi. A couple of questions about gaps, I guess.
Right.
Yesterday, there was questions or discussion of quantum events being, in a sense, the uncertainty there, the fuzziness there as being a place where God might act.
Yeah.
And depending on whether it's merely an epistemological thing or an ontological thing, that might be accused of being a gap that we're using to put the God into our interaction. The other gap issue is with the multiverse thing. The multiverse idea seems to be, and I think I hear you saying this, is it sort of a created gap, a gap of ungod, so to speak, people creating it as an idea to avoid the possibility of God's action.
Well, I think we have to ask the question, what's wrong with gaps? What's wrong with gaps is when they are simply epistemological gaps, they are simply gaps of ignorance, because they are likely to be closed by advancing knowledge. And that was the mistake of the physico-theologians, the development of the eye, and all that sort of thing. But there may be, and in fact I think there are, intrinsic gaps in nature, in the sense that particular levels of description don't tell you the whole story. And quantum physics may be an example of that. So I think we have to be discriminating about gaps. Not all gaps are bad. The second thing I want to say is that our knowledge, and here's another commercial, in a little book of mine called Exploring Reality, there's a chapter which talks about the physical the causal nexus of the world. And the main message of the chapter is that we don't know too much about it. We know a little bit about quantum theory. We know a little bit about classical physics. We don't know how the two relate together. As Peter Clark pointed out yesterday, chaos theory and quantum theory don't fit onto each other. They're incompatible with each other. We have a very patchy, unreconciled notion of the causal structure of the physical world. It is very unlikely that our ability to act as agents or God's providential agency is located simply at one of these levels. The causal structure of the world is much more subtle and complex than that. Our community, the science and theology community, spent 10 years wrestling with these problems, not wasted. Our ideas, whether they were quantum theory or chaos theory or whatever, were the toys of thought. They weren't serious answers to the problems. They're too difficult to be answered in that sort of way. But they did, I think, defeat the defeaters, as Erwin Mundram wisely said at one of our conferences. In other words, we can show that we can take science absolutely seriously and not believe that the world is causally closed on reductionist scientific terms. Science does not forbid me to believe I have free will to raise my arm, or that God has the freedom to act providentially in the unfolding history of creation. That I think we can say. And that's not an inconsiderable gain, but of course it would be nice to understand more than that.
Thank you. There was a lady on this side as well. Thank you.
I think it might have been touched on, I'm not sure. If God has limited his experience of time, has he limited his power to act?
Well, I think the two do go together, yes. Yes, I think God has limited his power to act. In fact, that's much more widely agreed than God's limiting God's knowledge of history. The theodicy question, which has sort of been popping up but not looming enough, sufficiently large on our scene, I think, in this conference. If we really believe that God is totally in control of everything, if we really believe that the universe, the history of the universe, is the performance of a score that God wrote in eternity, rather than a sort of unfolding improvisation in which God and creatures all play their parts. So I use these musical metaphors partly in memory of dear friend Arthur Peacock, who loved those sort of metaphors. If we really believe God's in total control, then it's a very odd world that God has chosen to establish in that sort of way. And I think the problems of theodicy become, well, I was going to say crucially difficult, but I agree, of course, with something I think George Murphy said, that ultimately Christian theodicy looks to the cross of Christ, God's participation in the suffering of the world. But I think it would be the closest both of power and of knowledge.
Now, I think we better go back to that end, because I've given this end a bit of a go.
I have absolutely no problem with Genesis chapter 1.
Okay.
I have enormous problems, and have had for my whole life, about the prophecies about the second coming of Christ. And the early apostles preached that Jesus was a king who was coming.
Yeah.
And the future is a much more serious problem to me than the past.
Yeah.
If you were preaching to your congregation on those verses, what would you say?
That's a very good question.
That's a challenge.
If you're like me, you've seldom heard a sermon on the second coming, to be perfectly honest. Every Sunday in my church we say, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. And we certainly discuss those first two statements, but we really don't discuss the third. I'll tell you what I think about it. I think that the second coming, which is certainly an inescapable theme in the New Testament, it's a symbolic theme, I think, and what it symbolizes is the eventual visible achievement of the Lordship of Christ. As the writer to the Hebrews says, we do not yet see all things under his feet, and certainly we don't. But it is our Christian hope and belief that we will one day. And I think the second coming is essentially a symbol for that. And I don't think it's a sort of timetable. I don't think it's a sketch of method, so to speak. If you think about the first coming of Christ, with hindsight, we can see that fulfilled the prophecy and hopes of the Old Testament prophets, by and large, in a very unexpected way. A crucified Messiah certainly didn't seem obviously on the agenda of Israel. And I suspect that the second coming will be as different from expectation as the first coming was, but as greater fulfillment of the hopes and expectations as in fact the first coming was in that context. So I think on the one hand, I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. I mean, incidentally, I've been stressing very much the contingency, the unfolding development of the world. It's perfectly possible to believe that God will bring about determined purposes through contingent paths. It's a very good book by David Bartholomew called The God of Chance, which discusses these things. So I think we should hold fast to the hope, but we should be pretty reticent about laying down when God's got to do it, and even more reticent about how God's got to do it.
Thank you, John. Now, there are still some hands up in that part of the hall.
God is spirit.
Speak up.
God is spirit.
Yep.
Have you any views on the spiritual universe? Because there must be a spiritual universe where there are beings, and how it is likely to interact with the natural universe, because most of what you say is more like the natural universe, ultimate product being atoms and molecules which we can touch and feel.
Well, that's a big question, and a very important question. I'm a dual aspect monist. I think that there is one stuff of created reality, but we experience that in quite contrasting modes, complementary modes, the material and the mental. Brain and mind, body and spirit, if you like. Of course, it's easy to say that and very difficult to work out what that means. But I think that's so. And if I'm trying to... One of the things I'm quite often trying to do when chatting with my non-believing friends is to raise their metaphysical sights a bit. And I'm trying to encourage them to take a wider and deeper view of reality than simply... a physicalist view of reality, a materialist view of reality. Going straight to God is perhaps rather a big leap. Halfway houses, there are two halfway houses that are pretty worth talking about, both beginning with M. One is music and the other is mathematics. Most mathematically-minded people think mathematics is discovery, not invention. It's not the contrivance of clever problems. It's the exploration of some noetic, quite spiritual, but on the way, a realm of reality that we have privileged access to. And that in itself, of course, makes you think that there's more to the world than simply matter. Similarly, music. I mean, I think in real-time conversations quoted George Steiner's remark in Real Presences, where he says the matter of music is central to the questions of metaphysics. In other words, if your worldview doesn't accommodate adequately the mystery of music, you haven't got an adequate view of the world. Music, if you ask a scientist as a scientist to tell you all he or she can about music, they will surely say it's neural response to the impact of sound waves on the eardrum. And of course that's true. But it seems to me that a lot of truth has slipped through the wide meshes of the scientific net in saying that. And there's much more to music than can be articulated in those reductionist terms. All these things encourage us to take a more generous view of the nature of reality. That's a little bit in the direction.
Thank you. Now, Peter has got his hand up. I think there are hands all over the place. It's quite hard to be fair to people, I think.
About God and time. We say that we are created in the image of God.
Right.
And so aspects of our character, like our appreciation of beauty, come from the character of God. Would there be a possibility to say that time is an attribute of the character of God? That time is an attribute of the character of God, and that somehow time in our universe reflects that attribute of God. I'm not saying that God is subject to time. I'm saying that could it be that that time is an attribute of the character of God?
Well, I don't think it's I wouldn't myself think that it was a necessary attribute of the character of God, because it's, as I said at the beginning, really, time, we believe time on the whole to have been finite, and God, I mean, a finite duration, and God has certainly not been a finite duration. So I think I'd want to say that. There's something else I was going to say, but I forgot what it is now. Somebody once said, I think it was Hegel, but it doesn't sound like Hegel, that time is what stops everything happening at once. And we need that. We're finite beings. And that's incidentally why our destiny beyond death is of infinite duration. We are finite beings, and we need to take things step by step, one at a time. God is infinite, of course, and doesn't need duration in that sense. So I'm a little bit wary of seeing an intrinsic time temporality as being an intrinsic attribute of God. I think it's more a graciously and canonically accepted engagement.
Well, there's a hand been trying to go up here. I think.
Let's go back to dark matter and dark energy. You know,
right,
they say 97% of our universe is in that category. And yet we have this beautiful theory, general theory of relativity, that seems to give us such an understanding of the cosmos. Could you speculate what would happen? I mean, if we don't understand 97%, how would you think that would affect some of these elegant theories that have been proven to be correct?
Well, of course, I mean, as I'm sure you all know, that Einstein saw that he could put in a cosmological constant, a dark energy constant, and he did that because he had the mistaken belief he had to have a static universe, and of course it didn't really do the job, because though the universe could be static, it wouldn't be stable, so that really wasn't very much use. So it's sitting there, and the mystery of dark energy, from our point of view, is that there's so little of it. I mean, 97% sounds a lot, but it's very small, 10 to the minus 120, of what there might be. There might be there. You see, it's possible. I mean, size and character are not the same thing. If the dark energy arises from vacuum fluctuations, which are suppressed by some mechanism which we don't know at the moment, then it's going to be a fairly simple thing to think about. I mean, it's an energy of space, but it doesn't have structure in it. I mean, it's got a bit of it here, you've got a bit of it there. So though it might represent a lot of energy, it might in fact be a very simple component structurally in terms of the universe and so on. So that, it doesn't disturb me, really. I mean, it's a warning, of course, that most of the things that are there we don't see. It's a warning not to be too full of self-confidence, I agree. But I doubt whether dark energy is a real problem.
Is dark matter more or less puzzling?
Dark matter certainly probably has more structure. It's WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. It's certainly got more to it than dark energy has, if we are thinking on the right lines about both, which of course we don't know for sure.
Quite. Well, there's a question there, yeah.
In 1978, Robert Jastrow gave a famous talk at the AAAS called God and the Astronomers.
Yeah.
And that was about the time when the Big Bang was considered to be really a true beginning of space and time and matter. Mm. And it didn't take long after that before theorists got busy coming up with ways to get it, to evade that, get around that idea, and thereby perhaps decrease this threat of theism that you mentioned. I'm wondering, for instance, Paul Steinhardt's theory on this brain theory, and Linde and some of these other spin-offs, and the multiverse idea and so forth. So what do you think that there is, there's a couple aspects of this. One is there's a kind of a sociology of knowledge level of this question. Motivations of human beings, pro or against theism, coming into the science. And then the other aspect of it is, what do you think is there in Christian theology, is there a constraint that causes us to prefer either a finite or an infinite universe?
Well, I think there's no. I mean, I tried to illustrate a little bit beginning that most of the most interesting questions are not simply scientific. They're constrained by science, but they also require meta-scientific decisions. Once you get that, then people are going to be motivated by all sorts of considerations. I mean, we can even go back before the Big Bang stuff to Hoyle and Bondi and Gold, who undoubtedly were motivated in looking for the steady-state universe because they thought it would get rid of a point of origin and would be less susceptible to religious interpretation. So everybody brings a certain amount of baggage in that sort of way. In the end, of course, with a bit of luck, some of these matters get decided for us. I mean, steady-state theory got killed off by the background radiation. These more speculative theories about the universe at the Planck time and earlier and things like that. I mean, it's hard to see how they can get killed off because they are so inaccessible to us. And even if, and it always remains, I mean, nothing comes from nothing. I mean, nothing comes for free. The universe is not a free lunch. And so you've got to have quantum theory and relativity theory and whatever puts them together, whether it's string theory or whatever. There's always some cost to be paid. And so there's always going to be some acts of metaphysical decision which are called for. And we're free to do that. I mean, it's perfectly respectable. It cuts both ways. It's perfectly respectable to allow one's religious belief to influence one's acts of metaphysical judgment. Just it's perfectly respectable atheists to allow their atheistic beliefs to affect them. But the important thing is to know what you're doing. And the irritating thing, of course, is when people present. It's the trick of scientism. Where what is actually metascientifically motivated is presented as if it were scientifically known. That's just dishonest. And Christians play that game as well as non-Christians, actually. I'm sorry to say.
Now there's a hand. Yeah. Yeah.
In closing, you mentioned that disorder always wins over order, which is a expression of the second law of thermodynamics, that the rate of change of entropy with time is always positive in the isolated system. Being subject to this law, we perceive time this way. Would God, who cannot experience disorder, not experience time in that way?
Well, I mean, the question of arrows of time is complex. There are at least four independent arrows of time. There's the, at least in our experience, the four arrows of time. There's the thermodynamic arrow of increasing entropy, increasing disorder. There's the complexification arrow of increasing the complex structure. And they're not contradicted because the structures come in dissipated systems that export entropy into their environment. I mean, the world has started as a ball of energy is now the home of saints and scientists. There's the arrow of the expansion of the universe, and there's the, for us human beings, there's the psychological arrow, maybe more than psychological arrow, that we can remember the past and not know the future. So there are lots of different arrows of time, and some of those are connected with our experience of the world, but most of them are connected with the character of the world. And God chose to bring into being a world in which the second law of thermodynamics holds. And I think that's because an evolving world in which great structure and fruitfulness is generated has to be at the edge of chaos. It can't be too rigid, it can't be too chaotic, it has to be at the edge of chaos. And that there's a connection, therefore, between fruitfulness and between order and disorder, between fruitfulness and entropy. So it's a sort of complex world. I mean, we all tend to think if we'd be in charge of creation, we'd know any better. We get all the nice things, we get rid of all the nasty things. But as people already said in this conference, that things are very closely entangled, and you can't have one without the other. And that's the world that God has chosen to bring into being. God knows that world, and I believe God accepts, of course, God accepts its character, and therefore accepts engaging with its character in accordance with that, with the character with which God has endowed it.
I think maybe we'll take one more question for John before we move on. I think we'll take the one at the back there. Hard to tell who was first, but...
Thank you. Thinking about this 10 to the 500 universes...
Yes.
If an infinitesimally small change to the cosmological constant causes the universe to blow apart...
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean that when it blows apart, it takes the multiverse theory with it? Because it's saying that this is the universe that exists because this is the only universe that can exist.
No, it's hard to describe. You start off with a theory which is in these 10 or 11 dimensional spaces, and you get a sort of symmetry breaking. There are transitions to local minima, which are locally stable. And this 10 to the 500 is an estimate of the number of such possible universes there might be. And if you start off at the beginning, in a pretty random sort of way, you would think in the end all these possibilities would be realized. And that generates this immense multiverse in that way of thinking. So I think the explanation of all of them would be there. In the trade now, they call this the landscape. It has a nice, pleasant, domesticated word to deal with this colossal ontological prodigality. And there's a book by one of the absolute firm people, and this is Lenny Susskind, and he's written a book called The Landscape, and he is absolutely explicit that the greatest attraction of the landscape for him is to diffuse the anthropic anxiety.
Absolutely. Well, we've been treated, I think. It's been a privileged time. So let's give John a great round of applause.